Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order for Tuesday, March 11th, 2008. We are going to try, if it's okay with you, Senator Olstein, to accommodate Senator Latz because he has to be over in the state office building. So if Senator Latz is ready, we'll take up Senate File 3302. You two figure it out. We want to get going, so.
Time is up.
We're done.
Senator Olstein, Senate File 3082. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're here today on Senate File 3082, which is about titles, markings on titles, and I would like to have the bill, if someone could move the A1 delete all amendment.
Oh, I'll move it.
Where is it?
Senator, do members have it? It's the A1. Yeah, I think it's at your desks. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Olstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I'm actually going to hand over the details to Larry Olala from Department of Public Safety to address the mechanics of the bill.
Okay. Mr. Olala, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. For the record, my name is Larry Olala. I'm with the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services Division. This is a departmental bill. What we're looking at addressing in this particular situation is a gap in the bill right now that allows vehicles that are older than 6 years old that are coming in from another state that have branded titles, because the branding law does not apply to vehicles older than 6 years old, those vehicles, when they come to Minnesota, will get clean titles. So in essence, it's washing or clearing the title. There's another portion of the bill that talks about dealing with reconstructed vehicles. The reconstructed portion would still apply to all vehicles, but we want to make sure that we address these vehicles that are coming in from another state is the primary focus of this.
So,
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Olstein and Mr.
Olaya? Olala.
This is that provision about 70% damage or more, is that what this is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, no, this does not impact that area at all. There's two places in the statute. One is under 325F under the .6641. That's subdivision one of this. It does not change that 70% area at all, nor does it address the 168A, the title statute, the portion that talks about the 70% area.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ola, does explain then what the branded means.
What the branded is that under 168A, 151, if a vehicle becomes a salvage vehicle in Minnesota, the primary way a vehicle becomes a salvage vehicle in Minnesota is when an insurance company purchases a vehicle for payment of damages. They have to apply for a title as a salvage vehicle. The other way that it could become a salvage vehicle in Minnesota is if an owner who is a self-insured owner declares that the vehicle has sustained 70% damage, it could become a salvage vehicle. When a vehicle comes in from another state and it has a salvage title, or when a vehicle comes in from another state and the damage of the vehicle exceeds the value of the vehicle, it would become a salvage vehicle. All those cases still remain. Once a vehicle becomes salvage, it has to go through a process to clear that salvage status. It has to be inspected, receipts have to be turned in, and there's a fee paid for that. The way that the salvage status is cleared then is it becomes a branded title. It's branded as a prior salvage once it goes through that process. And so what we're addressing in this particular case is the branding portion, not the salvage portion. Vehicles will still become salvage just like they are now.
Thank you. Senator Pretner Solon.
I was ready to move the bill.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Well, good. Let's do that then. Senator Pretner Solon moves that Senate File 3082 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Transportation Committee. Further discussion on the bill? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. That was pretty close to 2 minutes.
I don't know. Senator Latz had asked if he could go ahead. If you're okay, Senator Higginson will.
Thank you. Senator Latz. Members, it's Senate File 3302. It's probably in the bottom of your pile there. Senator Latz, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, what you have before you is a proposal that has arisen out of my direct experience trying to get information upon which to base proposed consumer legislation. You may recall I appeared before you last year with what was dubbed the Car Buyer's Bill of Rights. One of the questions that came up in the course of preparing that and discussing it with committees was where is the evidence that there is a problem that needs to be solved? Well, I thought it was a fair question. And in preparation for those presentations, I had sought to receive exactly that kind of information from the Attorney General's Office, Consumer Division, where they do receive complaints of consumers' nature, not only related to auto dealers, of course, but all sorts of purchases of consumer goods and other things. The Attorney General's Office is well-publicized across the state and among the bar of lawyers that if people have consumer complaints, or better, business bureaus and other places, they can contact the Attorney General's office often for help. What I found was that they were unwilling or unable to share with me information relating to the kinds of complaints that they got. They either didn't maintain or they were unable for data practices or other reasons to share with me any data relating to the types of complaints they got, the nature of the complaints, the number of complaints. And it seemed to me that that kind of information would be awfully important for the legislature to be able to make important judgments about what kind of consumer protection legislation would be helpful or perhaps is unnecessary because there isn't enough of a problem to be addressed. So what you have before you is legislation that would direct the Attorney General's office to maintain a database, including summary data, regarding complaints that they receive involving purchases of consumer goods. And then it specifies the information that should be maintained in that database. A database which would be accessible then to the public, including public policymakers, so we could make some better informed judgments about what we should or should not do to increase protection for consumers in Minnesota. Sometimes we hear anecdotally about problems. Sometimes we hear about the way problems are solved in other states. But this would give us a more of an evidence-based grounding for making public policy, which I think would be helpful in the long term. I have with me Nick Slade, a lawyer in private practice who does a lot of consumer protection work, particularly in the auto area, but he has a couple of thoughts to share with you as well.
Mr. Slade, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Nicholas Slade, and I'm with Barry and Slade. We're a private consumer rights attorney law firm, and being that we're one of the very few practices that practice exclusively in the area of consumer rights, we actually get a rather high number of calls from people who, after having gone to the Attorney General and tried to work out their problem through the Attorney General, oftentimes after the Attorney General deals with them and determines that there is a problem, because of the Attorney General's limited ability to represent individuals, they're often referred over to consumer rights attorneys, and I get a large number of calls. But oftentimes, I can't help them. But the important thing is that and that's why I've been working with Senator Latz to try and introduce a fair number of changes to consumer law. But one of the things that we're running into is the lack of knowledge of who is calling, the number of types of problems. And so I would really strongly urge that this be passed so that we can start collecting that data, because consumers, as things currently are going in Minnesota, face a tough uphill battle, and we need to be able to bring more legislation to try and correct some of the problems that I see on a regular basis, which oftentimes have no means to be properly redressed. And until we can show that these are wider problems, it's hard to formulate legislation. And so I would strongly urge this be corrected, and so we can start collecting this data, because consumers really do face a uphill battle, even though supposedly we're out there trying to protect them. And so I would strongly urge that we do start urging the Attorney General to collect this data.
Members, are there questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I have one question. Is there a fiscal note attached to this?
Senator Latz.
Not that I'm aware of.
Senator Latz, have you discussed this with the Attorney General's office?
They are aware of it. They've indicated to me that they have some concerns about it, but they have not approached me any further than that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Who was that? Senator Sparks.
Senator Latz, can you help me out a little bit, too? We heard a lot of discussion in this committee regarding some of the cell phone practices. On line 1.10 and 1.11, you talk about consumer goods. I'm wondering if a cell phone would be considered a good or a service, or do we define that anywhere else in the bill?
Senator Sparks, you mean the contract for use? I mean, the phone itself would certainly be a good.
Good, right.
The contract would be the service. Do you intend it? And on Senator Sparks' question, and Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Sparks, I would agree with what the Chair just stated, that the phone itself would be the good. The service contract would be the consumer service. Would not specifically be included in this bill. I'm open to anything that would help us collect relevant information.
I'm seeing a couple of folks in. Senator Gerlach.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if it dramatically changes the scope of the bill, but couldn't it just say goods and services?
Yeah.
So, Senator Gerlach, do you want to move?
I'll make that motion.
More services.
On line 1.12.
1.11.
Oh, I'm sorry. 1.11.
And 1.12.
And 1.12, we would... maybe council can read it for me. I'm sorry. We need to do it in two places there.
Madam Chair, I think on lines 1.11 and 1.12 after goods, we could insert or services.
And then would that be on 110, 111? That sentence would. Did you say both places?
Both places, yeah. Okay. On lines 11 and 12 after goods, insert or services.
Thank you. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay. Then any further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for getting here a little late, but I just had a question about this bill. Is this doing something similar to what the Department of Commerce is already doing? Do they have this type of information already available, or would it be a good idea to have something similar? Because I know they keep track of data in some way. I'm not sure exactly how it is tracked. And
Mr. Munson-Regala is here, so he could probably come up if you don't mind. And Deputy Commissioner in the Department. Senator Olson's right. I mean, the Department of Commerce gets calls. I think generally it's about insurance policies or something to do with banking or real estate, but those are services. And we'd like to know how that interfaces, if it does at all, with the Attorney General's, because we also know that the Attorney General gets calls. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
I need you to identify yourself for the tape.
Sorry. This is Manny Munson-Regala, Deputy Commissioner, Market Assurance Division, Department of Commerce. We do keep track of the complaints and calls that we receive, but they're for the industries that we regulate, the roughly 20 or so industries. So my suspicion is the Attorney General would get calls and inquiries on a broader scope than we would.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm just wondering, to the extent, if it isn't already available, whether Senator Latz would consider that we should have similar information from both the Attorney General's office and the Commerce Department.
Deputy Commissioner, Senator Latz, you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm certainly open to that as well. To the extent that we can aggregate all of the consumer complaint data that would give us a more accurate picture of the types of complaints coming in, I think that would give us a better basis for making policy decisions.
Deputy Commissioner, do you keep track of, I mean, if we wanted to ask how many complaints you receive concerning banking fees or realtor fees or whatever, would we be able to get that from you? Not, I understand, not what is not public data, but not who, but what? Can we?
Madam Chair, we do keep information on complaint data, perhaps not to the level of detail you're looking for. We could get that information, but it would require a manual process on our part, surveying our investigators to find out how many complaints fell in that category. I think the information we do have is aggregated at the industry level and by the nature inquiry. For example, in insurance, is it a claim inquiry or an underwriting inquiry? We have that level of detail.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I agree with Senator Lantz that it's good to have this kind of information so that when we're looking at if we're having problems with a particular type of thing, like with my wireless legislation, you know, what kinds of complaints are coming in or does it relate to a particular issue. But I would think that the Commerce Department would have an equal interest in knowing that kind of information from the Commerce Department. Are we having trouble with a particular insurance company or a particular line of insurance? Or is there a particular type of practice by insurance companies that we're getting a lot of consumer complaints over? So to the extent that that information isn't being tracked now, I would think that would be equally valuable type of information.
So, Deputy Commissioner, how does that... would that square with the department as it's constituted today? I mean, do you think that it would, if there were some language added here asking for the department's participation in this, or what, to have you establish a database parallel perhaps to what Senator Lantz is suggesting for the Attorney General's office, is that something that would require, you know, an increase in the budget? Or Deputy Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. we concur with the assessment that that the more evidence and data you have, the better informed your decision making is. And we can, in fact, collect that kind of information at the level of detail that you specify we keep it at. Our challenge would be, do our current systems support that sort of record-keeping assessment? We would also add that one of the things we're working on is conformity and uniformity with other states. So we're engaged in the process, and our Director of Enforcement, Robert Commodore, has just been named to a task force at the NAIC on complaint data standards. How do you be sure that you're counting apples and apples and not apples to oranges? So our only caveat would be that to the extent that you want information from the Attorney General today, to include us to a standard that needs to be conformed with that of the Attorney General may in fact slow down the data collection on the Attorney General's part, as well as impair our ability to collect the data that you're interested in. We agree data collection is important. We're not sure that applying the same standard to us is necessarily the right way to achieve your goal.
Thank you. Senator Olson, did you want to follow that up?
Madam Chair, Senator Lantz, is this going just to the floor, or does it have any other stops beforehand?
Senator Lantz, I think, and Senator Olson, I believe it's going to Judiciary.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, rather than spending more time on that now, then since Senator Lantz and I seem to be in agreement with the intent, maybe we can talk about it a little bit and see if there's anything workable for the Commerce Department that we could work out.
Yeah, and I would suggest that you make sure that it's in consultation with the department, and because I think it would be helpful in the long run. We just don't want to do something that makes it more difficult. We want, as long as you are in the process of developing some standards, and you know, for that would be important to have that input. So, is there any further discussion? Is there a motion, Senator Olson, on Senate File 3302 as amended, being recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Discussion, members? All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no.
No.
The motion prevails.
We're doing it again.
And the bill is recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary. Senator Letts and Mr. Slade, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins, still there. I see. And I think, Senator Higgins, there may be some people here concerning your Senate File 799, which was the interior design bill. I'm not sure if there are persons here. I was told there were that were not hearing that. Oh, they did leave. Okay. So thank you. Senator Higgins.
Okay,
Madam Chair.
Welcome
back here.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It's beautiful outside if you haven't been there.
Oh, no.
I'm sure you all wanted to know that.
We're jealous that you got out there. On Senate File 3214.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senate File 3214 seeks to clarify that the prohibitions, restrictions, and protections that are set forth in Chapter 58 apply to all loans secured by mortgages on 1-4 family residential structures. Currently, non-owner-occupied properties are not covered. Who knew? I didn't. This change affects the scope of Section 609.822, which makes mortgage fraud a specific crime in Minnesota. So we're making it clear that non-owner-occupied properties are also covered under the mortgage fraud chapter. The other very minor technical change in Section 3 deals with other vague reporting requirements for securities lending activities under Statute 61A.28. This small change will alleviate any misinterpretation. The language amends 60A.11 and 61A.28 to add language to clarify that health companies should follow the life investment statutes similar to fraternals. This change would impact only three insurance companies, Preferred One, Medica, and Health Partners. And with me today is Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce.
Mr. Murphy, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you wish to?
I have nothing.
If there are any questions,
to add.
Are there any questions of members? Not quite. I don't think we've done this. We've certainly been discussing Chapter 58, but I think this is something that we didn't do last year, and we realized we should have done. Is that what you were saying, Senator Higgins?
That's right. And, Madam Chair, like I said, who knew that it was they weren't covered? I thought that mortgage fraud covered mortgages, not just only the owner-occupied ones. So I think this is a good clarifying language to make sure that everybody is playing by the same rules.
And Senator Higgins, I think it doesn't have to go anyplace else, so it can go right to the floor. Is there a motion? Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 3214 be recommended to pass. It will go straight to the floor. Any further discussion, questions, members? On the Metzen motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your patience.
Sure.
And we'll see you this evening, Senator Higgins.
What did you say?
We'll see you this evening.
Oh, yeah.
Again.
Yeah. Other thorny issues.
Yeah. And Senator Marty.
Is that the
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1362 is a bill that would have health plans expand the mental health services they provide to include the benefits set for that's currently given for medical assistance. Last year, we did expand that benefit set to cover people with general assistance medical care and also Minnesota care, but this is a proposal that would increase it to have the health care plans do it as well. It's referred to as the model mental health benefit set. It does have more coverage than is otherwise provided for people with serious mental illness. And I have Sue Abderholden here from NAMI, the Minnesota chapter of NAMI, the National Association for Mental Illness.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Abderholden,
for the record,
welcome.
Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. For those of you who don't know, NAMI is a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illness and their families. About 3 to 4 years ago, we put together a group called the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, and it really was a coalition of all the different stakeholders, providers, families, advocates, consumers, and both public and private health plans. So the counties were at the table along with the private health plans. And our goal was really to create a public-private partnership to really improve the services provided to children and adults with mental illness. What came out of MHAG was a model benefit set. And what we looked at was all the research around the country about what works, what doesn't work, and we came up with a list of services that we thought were important to provide no matter what type of insurance someone had. Last year, as part of the Mental Health Initiative, the legislature passed those lists of benefits to make sure that they were included not only under medical assistance, which had been done a few years earlier, but also under Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care. Those services include ACT Teams, which is assertive community treatment. It's an evidence-based practice for people who have really the most serious mental illnesses. It keeps them out of the hospital. It's kind of a wraparound team, if you will, of the psychiatrist, the nurse, the therapist, the social worker, even a consumer educator. And it really does work in terms of keeping people healthy and in the community. Other services include ARMS, Adult Rehab Mental Health Services, which are kind of those in-home supports to an adult, Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, which are those services provided to a child and their family to keep the child at home, and what we call ERTS, Intensive Residential Treatment Services. And we really feel that those are really a good core of benefits and that really serve people with mental illness well in terms of keeping them in the community. I know that mandates aren't very popular, and I know for that reason this bill isn't going to be very popular, but I think it's important to raise the issue that as we really, our state is far ahead of many other states, really looks to making sure that people get the services, the mental health services that they need, when and where they need them, we do need to start thinking about a public-private partnership. And I will say that we have had a very good working relationship with the health plans as part of this MHAG committee. I know that we throw a lot of stones sometimes or large bricks at the health plans. But we've really had a very good working relationship with them. And what we've seen is they have taken over some of the publicly funded programs under managed care, under PMAP, that they've actually learned that providing ACT Team services is a really good idea. And they have started to actually provide them to some of the under their plans to the privately insured. And as we move into this preferred integrated network as well, they will get more and more experience doing that. So we feel that they are starting to make some progress, and we think that's a really good thing. One thing I would just mention is that if we really wanted to look at how can we provide this to another huge segment of Minnesotans so that they can benefit from these type of services as well, would be to even look at the state employee contracts. That might be, another good place to start to say, well, what would it cost if we were to cover state employees in terms of these benefits? And I really want people to think about this as, I've been around a long time. People have come to talk about particular cancer treatments being provided and said, well, the health plan said no, but this really will help save someone's life, and so we do need to make sure that it's covered. It's similar with mental health. Because if people don't get the treatment that they need, an effective treatment, we do, in fact, lose lives. And people do end up not being able to work and not being able to be active members of their community. So we think these are important services, and we should look at broadening this to a real, true public-private partnership in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Marty? And Senator Marty, this would apply then to the fully insured plans. It would not apply...
Not
to the ERISA,
right?
Governed plans.
That's correct.
Or the self-insured type plans.
Would the federal legislation
accept
that they're
the Wellstone? Oh, yes, it would.
And so, okay. I just asked Mr. Stang about federal action right now, and with the Wellstone legislation, could you just kind of tell us what's going on there? And I believe that would cover the self-insured and the ERISA-type plans, if you could, Ms. Abderholden.
Yes, Madam Chair. The Senate, as you know, passed their bill, you know, last fall, and the House passed their bill last Wednesday. It's important to note, though, that the federal parity law does not require that you provide mental health benefits, unlike the Minnesota law. What it says is that if you cover mental health benefits, you have to cover them in the same ways that you cover other health care. So you can't have different co-payments or different lifetime limits. But again, it does not require them to actually provide mental health benefits.
So it sounds like what we have now, what in fact I think is, I assume that's part of the repealer, that right current law in Minnesota is we aren't mandating to companies they must provide it, but or to plans, but if they do, then they must follow certain guidelines. Is that correct? Or
Madam Chair, I believe our law is actually a little broader than that, and that the exemption is for the small business that requires still a limited amount of mental health services to be provided.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any, like, if the state health plan were to adopt this, just any kind of a fiscal note or cost estimate on what it would be?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, I don't know. There's no fiscal note that we've seen, and I don't know what it would cost. I do know that one of the things that's been a trend in the last couple of decades is businesses and others are extending mental health coverage they thought would be very expensive. Earlier treatment and intervention often saves money, so they're finding out it's not the kind of expense they thought it was going to be. And I mean, I've been seeing that for a number of years with larger companies that do provide the benefits. But I think there's a trend in this direction towards doing this. Health plans here have been moving that way. The federal government's moving that way. It's been too long. Mental illness has been kind of there's been a big stigma behind all the people needing mental health treatment, and I think society's beginning to learn that, just like other kinds of health care, that this is very much needed and a big part of our health care system that we need to fill in. So this bill is intended to help try and keep pushing that process forward.
Senator Van
And I think, Senator, that it's a worthwhile goal. It might help us give us some perspective of what the cost would be if it was just applied to this. But thank you.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abderholden, I'm embarrassed to say I'm not sure what's not covered and what this would change, actually.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Solin, what it would do is it would require the model benefits that we've now adopted under the public program, so under Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and General Assistance Medical Care, to ask the private insurance, well, not ask, require them to actually provide those same benefits, those actual services under the private health plans.
But Madam
Senator
Chair,
Solin.
Ms. Abderholden, I thought according to our parity laws that already was required.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Solin, no, it doesn't require them to provide, for instance, ACT teams. It doesn't require them to provide ARMS. They are required to provide children's residential services, but the ACT teams and ARMS in particular are not.
Do members have an understanding of what those? I know you touched on it when you talk. Can you tell us briefly again?
Madam Chair, so right now, say if you have a plan under Medica or Health Partners, you would have access to inpatient psychiatric therapists, you know, that type of thing. What you might not have access to are things like an assertive community treatment team, which is a whole team of psychiatrists, nurse, psychologists that really wraps around the person. It's very intensive. It's someone who has the most serious mental illnesses, who really are kind of more treatment resistant and are really in and out of the hospital frequently. You might not get access to an ACT team. As an example.
And is it ACC?
ACT.
Just ACT.
Assertive Community Treatment.
Okay. And it's a team.
It's
as
a team.
In football team kind of thing. Yeah, I'm just not sure.
Madam Chair,
yes, right.
not quite as large, but yes.
Yes. Right. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, I am familiar with the ACT teams. But I thought those were provided by social services. I didn't think they were provided under the mental health benefits.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, they're actually a Medicaid benefit now, and Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care. So those can be provided, paid for through those means. And so this would just open up the different payment methods. Crisis services would be another example. I mean, that's something you would want anyone to access, whether they're under, you know, a private plan or a publicly funded plan, because it's a good methodology.
Okay. Are there further questions here? Then there are people who would like to speak to the bill, and maybe they could come up together, Mr. Hickey, Mr. Bartsch, and Mr. Stahlberger. I don't know if there's anyone else who wanted to join them. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
My name is Jeff Bartsch. I'm here today representing Health Partners. I want to thank Ms. Abdeholden for recognizing the work that the plans have been doing with the mental health advocacy community to advance this issue. I think it's something that we all recognize is an important issue to address for our patients and our members. It's interesting that in the disease management work that we do at Health Partners, the greatest return on investment comes from the work we do for people with mental illnesses, depression, et cetera, because we are able to get them back to work much quicker, because we're able to keep them out of an inpatient setting, which is a very common treatment place for people with mental illness. So this is an issue that we take very seriously. Okay. Our concern with the legislation that's before us here today is that it looks to take a benefit set that's designed for a specific population, the medical assistance population, and apply that directly to the commercial population. And those two populations are different. I think a few of the examples that Ms. Abdeholden mentioned, not necessarily Act the Arms, but some of the community-based or social services, those are services that are specifically designed for the medical assistance population. They are not a part of the commercial insurance marketplace. And that is where our concern lies, is that we're taking a benefit set that works for one group, trying to apply it to a second group, and we don't necessarily think that's the most efficient way to do it. We understand there may be some gaps in mental health coverage still today, but our preference would be to continue to work with MHAG and the other mental health advocates to find out where those gaps in coverage might be and where the commercial marketplace can target benefits for those specific services and not overlay services that are specific for the medical assistance community. So we'd like to continue working with them. We think that this approach is a blind mandate, reaches a little bit too far. And to Senator Vandeveer's question, obviously with any expansion of benefits, there is going to be a fiscal impact to it, although we haven't received a request for information from the Department of Employee Relations yet. With that, I'll let the other testifiers speak.
Mr. Stahlberger, welcome.
Good afternoon, members. Phil Stahlberger with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm not going to copy Mr. Bartsch's testimony, but I just want to also thank and reiterate the commitment I think that Blue Cross and other plans have had in working with the MHAG group, which Blue Cross and other health plans are obviously members of, working together to improve the mental health benefits. We agree with Ms. Abdeholden and Nami that maybe this bill maybe isn't the right direction to go if it does apply to the state or something along those lines, that maybe that's something we could look at. Given that cost is still the number one issue for small employers and individuals, we are receptive to some of their concerns and do want to continue our work towards improving the mental health services in Minnesota, but also want to work with our small employers and everyone else to do what we can to keep health care costs low, which I'm sure you'll hear from Mr. Hickey as well. So with that, I'll stand for questions and comments. Thank you.
Okay. I'll have Mr. Hickey come up, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Madam Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Hickey.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Mike Hickey of the National Federation of Independent Business, state's largest business group in terms of entities of 14,000 small businesses that struggle with this health insurance issue every year. I heard a comment earlier about mandates aren't very popular. To the contrary, they're too popular, Madam Chair. And you know it better than anybody when you passed the bill in 05 to try to give small employers relief from this. And we had quite a lively debate in the House on this yesterday, and the bill didn't fare too well, although it's still puttering along, and I don't know if it's going to get any time in your committee or not this year, but trying to make the 05 flexible benefit plan a mandatory offer so people can benefit from it. But anyways, today we're all on the same side, and I strongly want to echo what Jeff and Phil said. What is the cost of this? I hope this doesn't advance one inch until we know what the cost is to the private market. The last thing we need is to raise premiums further above and beyond what we've done. Everybody knows about the ERISA inequity. It's terrible. We're making it worse every year. So for a lot of reasons, I'd urge you to show caution on this and not advance this bill until you at least not even consider advancing this bill until you at least know the cost. And so that's about our only comments, is to keep this huge inequity in mind and the struggles of small business. Another interesting development that's occurred this year is Representative Bunn is trying very hard to enact a mandatory assessment of mandates bill, and it was something worked a long time ago with Senator Hottinger on. And we do have something on the books, but it's watered down. And this would be absolutely mandatory, and she's got a fresh perspective on this. But she's saying we've got to get a handle on this. We at least have to know what they cost and have to set up some kind of a process before we start doing this every year. And I just hope I'm not in here someday telling you that this new mandate's going to impact about 5 or 10% of the market, because that's where we're going. About 60% is not affected. The largest and richest are not, and the small employers in your districts who are struggling with health insurance are. So just wanted to share that with you and urge you to proceed with caution on this.
Senator Olson, do you have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just wanted to make a comment in response to that. Any type of health care we provide has a cost. And the question is I think, whether mental health concerns should be carved out and treated as a non-medical condition or a non-disease, and whether there's a fairness or involved in the way that the insurance companies have been handling that issue. When we know that that these are, whether we're talking about bipolar disease or many other things, that there are physiological reasons for these things that give them no reason to be treated any differently than any other medical condition. But beyond that, when you talk about cost, if someone is suffering from a mental illness, those services are going to have to be provided by someone, and there's going to be a cost that's going to have to be borne somehow. Whether taxpayers are bearing it because these people end up on government-sponsored programs that we have to pay for as taxpayers, or whether these people end up in homeless shelters or wherever they may be, if they don't get very cost-effective, simple treatment that might be able to be provided through medication or things that would provide them from not having to go into hospitals. The actual cost overall of providing mental health care as appropriate earlier on is a significant overall savings to the system as compared to not dealing with these issues. So we can't just look simply at the cost of a premium. We have to also look at the cost to society in all these other ways. And we also have to, in my opinion, just look at the equity of why it makes any medical sense to carve something out that shouldn't be treated any differently.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I wanted to follow up on what Senator Olson said very well, and that is that that there is a cost to not doing this as well. And when Mr. Bartz was talking about how it's a different population between the public program participants and the ones in the commercial market, the difference is that the people in the commercial market who have serious mental illness, partly because they don't get the treatment they need in some of these intensive interventions, they don't stay in the commercial market. They fall out of society and they get picked up by the public programs. So in effect, that's one of the reasons there's a difference in it. The more difficult you have with mental illness, the more likely you are to go on the public program where we as taxpayers foot the bill. And the whole issue with a lot of our health care, whether it's mental health or dental care and so on, is cost shifting in effect. Well, we don't want to cover it. That means the person who's getting it from the health plan right now doesn't stay in the health plan. Their health gets worse, and they get they drop out of employment, they drop out of everything else, and they end up on the public programs. So it's not that that there's something inherently different between somebody in a public program and a health plan. It's just that they're going to end up in the public program eventually if we don't take care of them here. So I'd like to make the case again that Senator Olson did very well, and that is that, you know, just ignoring it doesn't make the problem go away. It means the problem may go out of your health plan and into the public program instead.
Senator Metzen?
Yeah, I guess Senator Olson and Senator Marty said exactly what I was thinking, that if you can help somebody up front and nip the thing early and get these people back to work, or they'd be being taxed and they'd be paying taxes, and then you could also, there could be physical problems that come as we go through this process if you don't catch it up front. So I think if you look at a cost analysis, and I'm not a big person to promote the mandates either around here, but I think if you looked at what Senator Vandiver said, just the cost, I think you'd have to carry it the next step and see if there are savings down the road. And I'm sure there's a way to figure that out. It's like a dental problem. If you can catch that dental thing up front, you're going to save a heck of a lot of problems at the tail end, where the costs are going to be quadruple what they would be up front if you caught the stuff. So I just agree with Senator Olson and Senator Marty that I think you have to look at not just the cost, you know, to mandate it, so to speak, but the savings that would be affected too by getting these problems hopefully solved at an early stage.
Senator Vandiver.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, we kind of talked about savings and economic development a little bit yesterday too. It's just that I think they need to be documented better, and I just don't think my constituents can afford to have us save much more money here.
Mr. Bartsch, did you wish to say something?
Madam Chair and members, yes, thank you. I want to clarify something here to make sure we're on the right part of the conversation. I, too, was going to agree with what Senator Olson said, and I want to make very clear that the plans cover mental health benefits. We cover early intervention of mental health benefits, and we work very hard to keep people from entering into a crisis setting. So this bill is not about whether or not we provide mental health benefits. We do. It's a benefit that we want to provide. I just testified yesterday over in the House that this is an important benefit. What this bill is talking about doing is taking the medical assistance benefit set and the additional benefits that were added to public programs last year and adding those additional benefits onto the commercial population. So what we're here raising some concerns about is whether or not those benefits are specific and appropriate for the commercial population as well. I just wanted to clarify that for the record.
Mr. Bartsch, can you enumerate some of those? It's in 256B, right?
256B, I have the list, and Ms. Aberholder mentioned some of them, Madam Chair. Targeted case management services, for example, in 256B, we're required to pay counties or work with counties for case management. The plans have our own case managers for mental health, and actually they're quite excellent. So, you know, it raises a question of why are we contracting with multiple entities to do mental health case management.
And you'd be required to do that under 256B.
There's also 256B is a general statute applying to medical assistance benefits. So there's cost-sharing requirements in 256B. I'm not quite sure if those would also apply to mental health benefits now in the commercial population. For example, elimination of all co-pays. That's certainly not consistent with the commercial benefits that are in place today.
So you're saying, Mr. Bartsch, you wouldn't be able to have co-pays?
As I read the legislation, Senator Martin can correct me on this. But 256B doesn't allow co-payments for mental health services. And if we were to take the whole 256B benefit set and apply it to all mental health services in the commercial market, I read that to mean that you couldn't apply a co-pay in the commercial market as well. I could be reading that incorrectly, but, I mean, it's not the intent, but it raises the issue of we're taking a large chapter and applying it to the commercial market, you may not want to do that because there are specific benefits to the medical assistance population that aren't in place for the commercial population.
Okay. Thank you. Members? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and I can't speak for Senator Marty, but I would think that the greater concerns would be things like the limitation of coverage for mental health services that are in place in the private market. And I'm sure it isn't the same for every plan, so it probably varies from plan to plan. But I think that many of the plans there are many plans offered in the private market that have very much scaled back coverage for mental health services as opposed to what's available for in the public plans. And so I would think that the intent would be to try to make the coverage more comparable, not only to what's in the public plans, but to the type of coverage that you offer for other types of physical illnesses that aren't limited to, you know, if it's medically necessary, it's not going to be limited to 2 visits a year or, you know, I'm just, maybe I'm exaggerating or picking something out, but there are artificial limitations in what you cover for mental health services that may not make sense for that person. That would not be comparable to limitations that you have for treatment of other kinds of illnesses. And I think that the intent is to not again, be carving out mental health and treating it differently by putting those kinds of artificial limitations in place. At least, again, I don't know, I can't speak for Senator Marty, but we have discussed this subject generally, and I think that was a big part of the concern.
Madam Chair,
Mr. March.
And Senator Olson, I appreciate you raising that concern. I think there's a difference between what you are seeing in some large groups regulated by the federal government versus the health plans that are regulated by the state government. And those of us who are regulated by the state government do adhere to and do agree with the mental health parity law that requires us to offer equal benefits for mental health and physical health if we offer mental health benefits, as Ms. Abderholden alerted to earlier. In fact, we're also supportive of the language that's moving through Congress that would apply that same type of parity to all plans. So we are certainly not, as a health plan, nor do I think are the other state-regulated health plans, suggesting or wanting to carve out mental health benefits. In fact, we've been moving in the opposite direction, and I think Ms. Abderholden's testimony at the beginning would reflect that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair? There was one thing you said in the middle of kind of what you just stated, just to make sure I understand your position. You said you support mental health parity if you provide mental health benefits.
Which we do,
And you said which you do, but the whole point, I think, of this bill is saying that you will. And so,
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we provided mental health benefits for a very serious long time. We will continue to do so. In fact, there's a state law that requires us to do so in Minnesota. No health plan I know of in the state has any intentions of not offering mental health benefits. In fact, just yesterday, I argued that we don't want to ever do that, even though there were some that suggest we should. I want to make that very clear.
Okay. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, this bill would still need to get to my committee, which has not – it came here first. And I do think it has to be discussed there. I know that one of the points of this is to keep pushing the debate forward. I think Mr. Bartsch is right that the health plans have been moving forward on this. I'd like them to move a little faster forward. And I think it is important to recognize one of the reasons that he points out that the clientele of his plan and the public programs are different is because, again, the level of services, the entire benefit set that's provided does make a difference. And I think it does cause some of the shifting from these plans to the other ones. But I don't think this bill is... I'm not sure what the future status of the bill is, but it would be going to my committee next.
You know, Senator Marty, I mean, I know that there's a cost, but it's been really difficult to quantify the cost of our mandates. I have to say, as a person who has, you know, serious doubts about when we consider mandates, this may be the most appealing, however, because it's clear that we ought to be acting earlier for people. There ought to be intervention earlier rather than later. And that if an insurance plan won't cover, and I understand and I respect that our plans have do offer this, excuse me, in many cases. But if a person doesn't have it available through their plan, and for some reason or another they end up in the hospital and their plan covers the hospitalization and all of the costs that could attend to that, you know, that doesn't make sense. It makes much more sense to have it's just like anything else. But this, on the other hand, it isn't, because it has had the stigma and we haven't been willing to take the step. So, but I know you'll continue to talk to the plans and find out what they're doing. And you would have this bill go to your committee?
Yes, it would go there next.
And that is called Health?
Health, Housing, and Family Security.
Health, Housing, and Family Security?
I didn't name the committee, Madam Chair.
And do you think that the bill would be able to get a hearing in time, Senator Marty?
I'll have to ask the chair.
Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, just a point of clarification. Did I hear in the conversation that there's no copays?
Mr. Bartsch was saying that that is the way it is in 256B, which it is. That was not the intent of this, to change that in this bill. And that would have to be something we would have to look at the Health Committee, or we could do it here either way. But.
Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson.
I'm generally okay with the bill except for that piece. So you got to work that out.
And I think, Senator Marty, I think that's probably
true. Yes, I understand.
True. And I'm understanding that you're willing to do that. And I don't know that we have time for the language here, but I know that you're going to keep talking about this.
Yes, it would not come out of my committee without that change.
So Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1362 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee. Is any further discussion on that? Is there anybody else that wanted to testify? Seeing no one. On the Marty motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Same sign. The motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members of the committee will keep it.
And now, Senator Sparks.
Do you want a chair?
Senior. Oh, yes, Senator Metzen.
Oh, you got all the amendments? Just lost the bill. What is that? How many amendments you have? 6 or 7 hours. We were working on it. I was trying hard the whole day. Just didn't have it.
We have before us Senate File 3467, Senator Scheid, Miscellaneous Commerce Provisions Modifications. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, proceed.
It's great to be here today, Mr. Chairman. And fortunately, I have some gentlemen here from the Department of Commerce who are going to help me get through this, because you can tell my voice is failing me yet again. But this is the annual bill that comes from the Commerce Department's Market Assurance Division. It's the one that I like to kind of chide them a little bit. Each time I say market assurance, I think, I know it has more to do with than just consumer protection, but I'd like it to, you know, include consumer protection more out front there, but that it does include other activities of the department as well. So it's this bill seeks to update some of our statutes to conform with the federal laws and regs, and it's making some technical changes and some clarifications where we need to do that. Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Ragala is here, as you know, and Mr. John Gross from the department to discuss the bill and answer any questions that you have. I do have an amendment. It's the A08-1316. It's an author's amendment and looks pretty technical kinds of changes. Anyway, it puts the bill in the order.
Is that the A13-16?
16, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, it deals with the...
I'd move that amendment.
On the Scheid amendment. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, just out of curiosity, non-smoker, we capitalized it in the past and no longer capitalize it? I'm assuming
Chairman,
that's what that change is about.
Mr. Chairman, it's not to diminish the importance of it. I think it's probably style
is this one, all right?
Preferred by the revisor's office. I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing that.
Any other change would be on
there's some new language on page 3, but
the inflation factor.
As I said, it is an. This is our first stop, and we can discuss the bill then.
All right, let's put this on, and all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Scheid.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might just, I think I should offer the A6 because it's an author's amendment, but you might want to. Is there? Do you know?
Is that a grammatical?
Yeah, Mr. Gross brought
it. It's just a couple lines, and I think.
Mr. Gross, did you suggest this or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Gross with the Department of Commerce. Yes, Commerce has made this suggestion. We've got, they're more or less little technical things, some glitches we made in the original bill, and
right.
We're just clarifying the language.
Senator Scheid moves the A6 amendment.
Aye.
Senator Brentner-Sullivan before the.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, wouldn't it be better on page 4, line 1, if you also struck who are and just put who must be enrollees or covered under an individual plan.
Where are you? I'm sorry.
On page?
On the bill.
4.1.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You see that? We're trying to find that. I think grammatically that's. You approve that, Senator Marty?
You betcha.
you pass English and. Ninth grade?
Absolutely.
Was you a good one?
Mr. Chairman,
you ain't got no.
Could Senator Prentner-Solon repeat that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I just think that grammatically it would be better if you struck who are and just put must be plan enrollees or covered under an individual plan.
Could that be an amendment to this guy somewhere?
You want to eliminate the R as well.
Yeah. Who are?
Who are?
Okay, do you need an additional amendment we could do?
It's kind of.
Okay, I think we'll take the Scheid A6 amendment first, if that's all right. That's on your desk. And I think there's no disagreement there. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, motion prevails. Now we're going to look at the.
Right.
Senator Prentner-Solon's new language, could you report that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think Prentner-Solon suggests deleting the words who are on line 4.1, so it would read, must be plan enrollees or covered under an individual plan subject to assessment. Is that correct?
Yes, and if you start reading from the previous line, it does make more sense.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's fine.
Okay. But you understand the Senator Prentner-Solon's amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Okay, now we're.
Now, Mr. Chairman, now I'm ready to discuss the bill, and I think there are other amendments, but I'd prefer that we get through the bill and then we'll talk about those.
Sounds good.
So who wants to go first?
Oh, that's the.
John, you know. Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Manny Munson-Regala, Deputy Commissioner for Market Assurance, and we'll work on a new name, Senator Scheid. The bill, as Senator Scheid mentioned, is a technical conformity bill. There are a number of provisions in federal law or in NAIC model regs or statutes that we are trying to come into conformity with. For the most part, Mr. Stang has done a wonderful job of explaining the different sections, what we intended to do. The majority of the changes are in the health or long-term care context, and Mr. Gross will be spending more time talking about that, but that's the intent of our bill.
Okay. I don't think most of us are too concerned about the housekeeping and the conformity stuff, but it's the
anything
the meat and potatoes in there that we want to, at least I would like to talk about or hear about. Mr. Gross.
You know what we think would be important.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think the, let me emphasize sections 9 through 30 you deal with long-term nursing care coverage. And Minnesota has been a strong advocate of trying to promote that type of coverage in Minnesota.
Can I and just say it starts with page 6, I'm sorry, that's of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Scheid.
I'm sorry.
And our goal here is to make sure that Minnesota's long-term nursing care statutes are identical that you find in other states. One of the problems we had years ago was we came up with some unique Minnesota version of long-term nursing care coverage, and that prevented various national associations from marketing long-term nursing care coverage in Minnesota because they did not want to provide a Minnesota-specific certificate, and that entity was AARP. So, again, our goal is to try to have standardized long-term nursing care coverage throughout the country. The if you go to this, what is this?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the AO8.
The first office amendment, Mr. Chairman, 1316.
1316. If you turn to page 3, line 3.29, what Minnesota is trying to encourage is people to purchase long-term nursing care insurance, and it's called the Partnership Program. And it's a partnership between the policyholder and the state and the federal government dealing with medical assistance, or MA. And if the person purchases a partnership policy and they use part, let's say they buy a $200,000 policy and they use $100,000 of that policy, under the partnership program, they get to keep $100,000 of their assets. And what this language is trying to do there is spell out the inflation protection that has to be required under the federal law about inflation protection. In the past, inflation protection was an option. Now it has to be mandated. And what we're trying to point out there is the types of inflation protection that would qualify. And we're trying to make sure that the inflation protection that's offered in Minnesota is affordable. Then if you turn to page 6, starting on line 6.31, we're modifying our right to cancel provision. Those are when a person receives a policy, they have usually 10 or 30 days to look over the policy, and if it's something they did not want, they can return it. And we're just trying to make it real clear how that works. Those are truly or basically the significance of this bill. Like we've said before, most of this is purely technical to be in conformance with either federal or NAIC provisions.
Well, just let me make one quick comment. When this long-term health stuff is really important for so many reasons. And what we don't do around here, and it's partially my fault, is give enough tax credits to purchase this product. I think the state gives you $100 credit, and this stuff, if the taxpayers are paying for it, at the end of the day, it's about $4,000 or $5,000 a month. We should, and I don't know the price tag, encourage people more, and you're trying to get that to that goal line, Senator Scheid and the Commerce Department, but I think we ought to start looking longer and harder at the tax situation instead of just giving $100 for Jim Metzen to buy, you know, $150 a day or something, because then you folks hopefully later on won't have to pick up that tab for me. So all I get for paying $4,000 or $5,000 a year for this product, I could say no and let somebody else do it later on in society. So that's my pitch today, that and I should be pushing that. I guess I'm not, but I wanted to make that an awareness thing that I think we've got to get that 100 up that it's been at for years to something to encourage Senator Olson or anybody else to buy it, give them more incentive. So that's the end of my speech. But
and I think, Mr. Chairman, and if
really, you got to encourage people to buy it. You know, give them some more reasons.
And I think that what Mr. Gross is describing on page 3 of that amendment that we adopted has to do with the partnership policies. Does that relate to Senator Berglund's legislation that she had a year or so ago?
Yes.
That's a federal program to make it easier for people, and I think to be able to carry over some benefit. Does it do that?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scheid, was that the program that had to do with negative amortization of your, or not negative, I mean a reverse mortgage that you would use the equity in your home to fund this? There was something like that that we looked at a year. This is something different?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, no. I don't know if Mr. Gross wants to explain that. It was...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the reverse mortgage was another idea that we're trying to encourage people to be able to stay in their homes by being by using their home as an equity, and then they're being paid monthly money. And part of the goal is, to, like I said, to keep people in their homes. It's another an incentive to help people financially not become burden on society.
That's different.
But this partnership.
Excuse me.
And if you could.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the partnership program, again, is a different type of program. Originally, there were four states in the country about 15 years ago that had this. The federal government in 2005 wants the other 46 states to encourage that. So Minnesota has been working on that diligently since then to accomplish that.
Any further discussion on the bill, Senator?
I know there are some amendments. Oh.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, or Mr. Gross, Section 7, which I'm assuming is technical, both from your description and the looks of it, I'm just curious why you're defining alcoholism as separate from chemical dependency services. Were there some questions of whether chemical dependency services include alcoholism?
Page 5, Mr. Chairman, yeah. Section 7.
I've never seen that separated out that way, and I'm just curious why.
I mean, my alcoholism is separated.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, if you go back to sections. Section 2 and 3, we're modifying those statutes to conform to the parity law, and we were suggested, this was being suggested by Tom Penner, House Research, but we were suggested that we put the word alcoholism in.
Alcohol.
It's in current law. In Section 2 on line 20.
It's in, like Senator Scheid points out, on Section 2, line 2.20, the word alcohol is in there, and we thought we would put this into the parity law, 62Q.47, which is Section 7 on page 5 point, or line 5.5, just to make it clear. We're including, besides alcoholism, we're including chemical dependency.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gross, I'm not going to take it out, but I think in line 2.20, both alcoholism and drug addiction have generally been classified as part of chemical dependency, and the only reason I raise the concern is separating it out might mean that others think other times when we use the term chemical dependency that it doesn't include. I mean, I don't know what there is to chemical dependency other than alcoholism or drug abuse or addiction, but
I agree.
I kind of wonder why we can't just use drug chemical dependency to relate to all three of those, both on page 2 and on page 5.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I would consent to that. I think it would be clearer then.
Mr. Chairman, in that case, I would move to strike alcoholism, comma, on page 2, line 20, or drug addiction. So it would read for the treatment of chemical dependency to any Minnesota resident. And then on page 5, strike the new language in Section 7. I guess strike Section,
strike section
7 altogether.
Yeah.
All right. Do we understand the party new language here? I think Senator Johnson, have you looked at that? Is that all right with you?
Mr. Chairman, it's fine with me. I think Senator Marty makes a good point.
Any questions from the committee on Marty?
Sent.
All those in favor, signify by the same.
Aye.
Further amendments, Senator Sparks? Yeah. There's about three amendments at the desk. I don't know who's responsible for them. We're doing a Senator Sparks.
Yeah, I do have an A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Clerk, or...
Mr. Chair, maybe while they're handing out, I can explain a little bit what's going on here, and then if we need further clarification, we can get that. But 2 years ago, I carried a bill that was enacted into legislation governing the sale of consumer goods and home service contracts and the entities they provide. The legislature adopted national standards in place of the industry in a majority of the states. At that time, however, Minnesota's existing law governing service contracts covering motor vehicles was not updated. And I think what this amendment does, and there's agreement, and we can certainly ask them if they want to come forward, would just do that. Paul Cassie is here to describe the amendment in more detail. I think the auto folks are okay with this as well, Mr. Chair.
They would be.
Okay, let's hear from those that are affected by this briefly, and hopefully we have agreement.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Peter Frame, and I represent the Service Contract Industry Council. Senator Sparks' explanation is correct. This is designed to sort of complete the work that this legislature began in 2005 to put auto service contracts under the authority of the home and consumer service contract legislation that was enacted in 2005. I'm not aware of any opposition from the Department of Commerce, from the manufacturers of automobiles, or from the Auto Dealers
Association. All right, let's ask for any opposition to this. Has the Department of Commerce had a chance to look at it? Have you, sir?
Senator, we're fine with the amendment.
Okay, anybody in the audience opposed to this language? Seeing none, Senator Sparks renews his motion that the amendment A1 be adopted. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
And Mr.
Further discussion, Senator Shine.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can be of help here on the other amendments. The A5... And I'd ask Mr. Marsh to come up. It has to do with some language, I think, that we adopted last year, 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Marsh, identify yourself for that. You can start explaining it.
Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutuals. 2 years ago, Senator Scheid carried a bill for us for our companies that weren't grandfathered to sell homeowners in second-class cities that they could go through the department to get approval. There was an error in the drafting in that one company is incorporated under a special statute. It's the same as all the rest of ours. There's a couple little tweaks that are different. However, when we drafted the bill, we missed this one reference. So one company out of our 96 is not able to sell in cities of the second class. So the department's fine with this. This should be just a technical thing that meant to be in the bill 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that describes it very well.
I remember doing this. Senator Scheid, do you agree with this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Senator Scheid and the Commerce Commissioner's office, fine.
Senator Mitchell, that's correct.
Okay, on the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Have another amendment, Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I don't know if Mr.
Senator Marty.
One technical amendment to the one we just adopted. It's very tiny, but I would, on page one, line five of the amendment, strike the word both because we're referring to three different things instead of two, and I think both usually means this and that, not three different things. And you don't need the word both in there?
Okay, Senator Scheid would throw
out. Mr. Chairman, could you, I'm sorry.
On the amendment, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, just on line five of the amendment, strike the word both because you're referring to three different things. It's purely technical.
Are you talking about the amendment we just?
Yes.
She'll withdraw her amendment and offer the new amendment with that change. Is that correct?
Yes.
On the A5 amendment as amended, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Scheid, what do we have the...
Thank you. I come with a technical bill, and Senator Marty gets even more technical, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate
it. Technical guy, that Senator Marty.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think we'll do the A2. And Mr. Andrew Morrison is here to discuss that, and I believe it's accurate to say the department is... Yeah, you've worked with the department
in
developing this language.
Okay, give us a brief explanation, sir. That is it the A3?
No, A2.
The A2, and then we'll do the A3.
Thank you, sir.
Good day, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Morrison, and on the A2 amendment, I represent the Builders Group, which is a commercial self-insured group for workers' compensation authorized by Chapter 79A. And we're making three small technical changes in the operation of the group. When these groups started, we had a few members. My group has now over 1,000 members, and we determined that we no longer need to do all the paperwork necessary to meet the minimum requirements of the Department of Commerce. The first section is that instead of notifying the Department of Commerce before a member is adopted in a group, we have 5 days after that membership is adopted to give that to the Department of Commerce. As you can imagine, with 1,000 members, that's it's a lot of time-consuming work. Now we have 5 days to get that to Commerce. The second is, if a member is delinquent, instead of within 15 days going after him for more money, we now have 30 days, which is pretty standard in the industry for insurance. And the third change is that we have to prove to the Department of Commerce the net worth of the group to make sure we're solvent. With 1,000 members, we used to have to send 1,000 reports to collect them. What this does is means that we can take our biggest members, meet the minimum requirement, and once we meet it, we don't have to have 1,000 copies filed. And those are very technical amendments, Your Honor. Mr. Chair, and I will stand. I've been in court a lot this week, but
I've been called a lot of things in this committee.
Yeah. Please, Mr. President.
Madam Chair, Your Honor, and
that's the
I don't know if that's a promotion or not, but are we all right with that, Senator Scheid and the Commerce Department?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe.
Yes, Senator, we are.
Okay, any comments or questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Do we have one A3 amendment?
On the A3, Mr. Chairman.
500 to 15,000 or on page 2, whatever that does. Is that yours, sir?
Yes.
Would you address me as Your Honor, please?
Okay.
I like that.
Oh, I couldn't
do that. Haven't heard that.
Okay, before. Mr. Chair, and for this amendment, I am the general counsel of Minnesota Self-Insured Security Fund. This fund is created to make sure when a company goes bankrupt, like National Steel, that injured employees are paid. Because the employer no longer has any money, we get the Social Security, we pay the members. What's happened is we have a lot of members who have left the state, who have left self-insurance. And the members that these affect are members who have left more than 10 years ago.
Members meaning the companies.
Members being individual self-insured companies. And what happens is they have to pay us an assessment when they exit, a final assessment at some point. To calculate that was very expensive, required actuaries. Now that this class of former members is all more than 10 years ago, the tail in the workers' compensation is almost minimum. Rather than creating an expense for them and for us, we have just simplified this to include $15,000, include most former members. They have a simplified method of paying us a one-time assessment. This does not affect the Department of Commerce's ability to keep posted security. It just affects our members and ability to get one more assessment from them. And a simple calculation and save everybody actuarial costs.
Okay, anybody opposed to this amendment?
No, because all the members who are currently
paid it,
yes, paid it are my members. So there is no opposition.
Right, Senator Scheid, you're right with this?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I think the department has
We're okay with it.
Discuss this with him.
Okay, Senator Scogin moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill as amended? Further discussion. Would you care to move the bill as amended, Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, yes, please.
Okay, on the Scheid motion, I believe it doesn't have to go anywhere else, does it? Right to the floor, it's okay. On the Senator Scheid's motion to recommend approval of Senate File 3467 as amended, it's sent to the floor. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
And we're going to recess, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, that's right. Senator Marty, before
Your Royal Highness, I was just going to ask you. What time we're recessing to?
Mr. Chairman.
6 o'clock.
We'll meet in here at 6 o'clock.
The committee's
we have the two bills on payday lending tonight.
Okay.
And I've removed the bill on what's called STOLI or life settlement, so that is not on the agenda. I don't think it will take too much time. It's Senator Pappas and Senator Higgins have a bill. And for members of the committee and staff, there is supper in G9 starting about 5 o'clock.
Steaks? Great.
And Senator Metzen is going to barbecue steak, I think.
No.
Hey, John.
Okay.
We're recessed until 6
committee's
o'clock.
In, Congress committee's in
That's
recess till
Thursday, right?
6 o'clock.
Thank you. And I...